to get to your bucket rules, which I think are so good, and I even have a favorite. But right before we get into that, let me bring up the topic of meaning in the healing process. You have a whole chapter about that, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly. And it's something that I think about a lot. And Viktor Frankl put forward this great little idea, which he expressed with the equation D equals S minus M, which is despair is suffering without meaning. And right. And his big thing, isn't it just, I find great strength in that quote.
He also, and you remember this from the book, he also, and I'm just going to totally butcher the actual words that he, I don't remember verbatim what he said, but he said something to the effect of, you know, and this was actually what probably helped him and other people survive the Holocaust. You know, people can take everything away from you, but they can never have your thoughts. Right. That was, and I use that with my patients just to drive home this point that their narrative is all they are and all they have. At the end of their lives, like, people are going to lose people, clothes, weight, cars, jobs. At the end of your life, really, you're a sack of stories. Right. So let's make them good, because everything is constantly changing. But I do love, I think there are some incredibly wise lessons and wise words that he shares with us. And, you know, I think that when people can find meaning from their experience, they can end up even healthier. And we call that, I think probably what you're referring to and wanting to talk about, is post-traumatic growth. It's not a new thing that's just suddenly happening to people. It's been around forever, but we just keep reinventing the wheel in terms of the terminology. And with, I think, the real push in the field towards positive psychology in recent decades, there's this real push to focus on positives, focus on strengths, and not so much on the pathology and weaknesses, and there's a problem, you're diseased, you're disordered, right? And so this idea of post-traumatic growth is just the idea that we may not only come back to baseline, but grow beyond it, which, you know, we have, the caveat is, if you were already healthy before trauma, I mean, we want to get back to healthy, right? If you're as healthy as it is, then there's really not a whole lot of growth to do, but it just serves as a reminder of just being grateful and having gratitude and keeping priorities straight in your life. And I would say that I fall into that category. I was really healthy. I won't say I've always been healthy my whole life, but in recent decades, you know, in my own growing through being in this field, and constantly introspecting and being self-aware, I was so grateful even before the massacre, but then living through it, I think the growth that I did have is I kind of refocused on certain things, and it was a good reminder of, like, what's really important: family, friends, health, and that sort of thing. But for people who were unhealthy prior to a traumatic event, maybe they had pre-existing mental illness or just a pre-existing biological and genetic predisposition towards anxiety or depression that runs in families, right? Just like diabetes and heart disease and cancer runs in families, so does mental illness. I think people don't really realize that because they don't think of it as an actual organ. But I think when you do, we start to recognize that, you know, that it's not our fault, but we do have to take responsibility and care for ourselves. So people who have come into a traumatic event with previous experiences of trauma or mental illness, they probably are at much higher risk of being in that small subset of people who develop PTSD or another chronic disorder if they didn't have it before. And they will likely get stuck, because what got them stuck was a set of core beliefs and lifestyle habits or behaviors that, or stories that was just, to begin with, wasn't good for them, right? And so, I'll give you an example. A lot of my patients will say, you know, I want to be the old me. And I always say, no. We don't want to be old you. Old you got you stuck. Let's be new you, right? Because the old you that got you stuck, and now it took you 10 years to ask for help after combat or after being raped or after, you know, or 40 years after child abuse, that's really unhealthy. That emotional constipation is what led to a whole host of health problems now at, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50. So no, I don't want old you, right? We actually need to fix this problem. We need to dig into your core belief systems, your worldview that started to be established when you were a child, right? And we need to fix that. And you know, interestingly, but not surprisingly, one of the things that in and of itself gets people stuck is this mindset of, I can't show weakness. People will think I'm crazy. I can't tell anybody that I'm struggling. So it's the nail in the coffin, right? And it's really tragic when you think about it. We know, I mean, these numbers are never totally accurate because of the nature of the what we're talking about. But we know, like, at least half of all suicides, the person never told anybody, and people are surprised, right? And so for that reason, I always tell my patients, secrets make us sick. Secrets make us so sick, they can kill us. Slowly or quickly, literally. That emotional constipation, no different than physical constipation, can kill you. It is a medical emergency. And literally that in and of itself, that one thought process can lead someone to develop PTSD. Right? PTSD does not develop because we went through trauma. In order to say that, we would have to say everybody who went through trauma develops PTSD. But actually, we know that 70 to 90% of people who go through trauma recover. The 70 is only for mass violence, right? It's half. So 30% of people, we think, develop PTSD after mass violence. It's half that number for every other kind of trauma. Believe it or not, even natural disaster, combat, rape, child abuse, domestic violence, it's extraordinary, right? So it is there's a very specific reason, a very good one, that subset of people get stuck. And we can't even say that it's necessarily anyone with a sensitive brain, because probably half the population, I mean, we know 1 in 3 people in this country have a diagnosed anxiety disorder, 1 in 4 about have a mood disorder. That's just the people who asked for help. I mean, how many people can you think of right now that probably meet criteria for a clinically significant disorder but have never gotten help? I suspect it's over half the population that has sensitive brains, right? We know that easily over half the population will have a depressive episode or some sort of mental health problem in their lifetime. It's probably well over that, because so many people feel stigmatized and ashamed and don't talk about it, right? Which of course is part of the problem. So, you know, back to why do I do that? Why do I, you know, want to teach people? Because I think that we can save a lot of people. I think we can spare some of those suicides, maybe not all of them, but a whole ton of them. And I think we can spare people a lot of, you know, productivity and performance problems. We know that depression is the number one cause of disability and days lost from work in this country, right? I don't know if people don't realize that. And suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in this country. Suicides have gone up across all age groups, and specifically the most in the age group of 10 to 14, which is unfathomable, right? It's just unfathomable. And it's gone up 60% in the past decade for that age group. That's crazy. That's not acceptable, right? So, you know, this is why it's so important for us to get better. And, you know, where do we start? I know you'd ask the question, like, how do we fix this problem? How do we fix it? I think we start with kids, right? But as adults, we have a responsibility too. And it's to get ourselves educated and to lead by example and to make it okay for our kids to cry and open up about how they're feeling, to get help for the things for their brain, you know, imbalances or neurochemical changes. I think that, you know, if we do that and we start teaching these things in elementary school, there's no reason why an elementary school level child can't learn cognitive behavioral therapy and or the cognitive behavioral theories, right? There's no reason why they can't learn about this bucket idea, yeah. Right? There's no reason. So
there's a, just to kind of really, because part of what I hear you saying is the importance of processing those emotions, talking about what you went through, going there. Some colleagues and I did a study last year, and it's in publication, and it was mainly about the experience of transformation, defined as a significant and lasting change in your way of being, where your way of being can include your perception, your thought patterns, your emotional patterns, your behavioral patterns. And we found many interesting results, but one of which was that among all the catalysts that people could have selected for what initiated their transformation, trauma or emotional distress was by far the most frequently selected. And then one of the most interesting results to me, we had a question which was, rate the degree to which you feel that your process of transformation has reached a relative completion. And of course, emphasis on the word relative, like there's no true end, you know, but we were conceptualizing transformation as a process that had a relative beginning, middle, and end. And so then we then looked at the people who rated the highest score for that, 85 and above on a scale of 100. So they were saying, basically, I feel like I have transformed. I've gone through the process and kind of finished it. And we looked at that group and found that the main factor that led them to that was self-expression, that there was this super strong correlation between what we described as change stabilization and self-expression. And then we did a survey, we did some interviews. So in the interviews, we got a better understanding of what that meant. And what it meant for people was that they actually talked about the traumatic experience. And it also meant that they had creative self-expression and that they were generally less inhibited. And sometimes that even manifested as becoming a little more assertive or having hard conversations, not holding back. So those were kind of the meanings of self-expression.
Research. Absolutely. I mean, that is so interesting. And yeah, I would say that's really kind of in the wheelhouse of the post-traumatic growth, right?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. I think, you know, at least that's the hope, right? That people go through trauma and it helps them kind of rethink and just recategorize, reprioritize. Mm-hmm. That list of what's most important. And, you know, it's funny because as you were describing the research that you were doing, and I was kind of thinking to myself, like, have I reached a level of relative transformation? And I don't know. I'd probably need to talk to you a little bit more to really conceptualize and operationalize some of those terms. But just as a general construct, as a general idea, I have to tell you, I am happier now in my life than I think I've ever been. I am at most peace with myself. I feel most comfortable in my own skin. I feel for the first time in my life that I truly can live unapologetically. And, you know, I feel that this sounds a little corny, but I feel at one with myself. You know, I feel like I have reached a level of true authenticity. I mean, I get to let it all hang out and not apologize for it. And, you know, I can't tell you that that doesn't have anything to do with Route 91, because even though I was really, I think, healthy prior, I don't know, it's like a sense of clarity has set in and a sense of peace. And, you know, of course, that even though I was grateful for everything before, I have just infinite gratitude now. And it's very clear in my life, in my mind, what's important and what's not so important. So, I mean, in that sense, you know, I guess we would hope that everybody would go through that kind of growth and, you know, get that divorce finally, if they were planning on it, or quit that job and go travel, or, you know, pull the trigger on whatever it is was or might be that they wanted to do, wanted to become. I think, you know, a big take home from going through something like that is you just don't know when your number's up. Mm. You know, so I think living more mindfully, living, I don't want to use the word carpe diem, but really just sitting happily in every moment that you have of your life, every moment. You know, and if you're not happy, then using that compassion statement, I'm having a moment of suffering. Suffering's a part of life. May I be kind to myself in this moment. And it's okay. This is part of my humanity, right? We don't appreciate the sun unless it rains once in a while or snows once in a while. Mm-hmm. We don't appreciate the happiness if we're not sad once in a while. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. But I love that research sounds very interesting.
Nice. Like, well, I'll let you know it's published. It's almost there. Yeah.
I'd like that.
Cool. So, and I just love to hear your reflection on how at peace and at one with yourself you are. That's beautiful, really.
And thank you, Matt.
Yeah, and perhaps a testament to these bucket rules that I know you practice and not just preach. So let's talk about Dr. G's 5 bucket rules and what the bucket is.
The bucket rules. You know, it's not like I created these concepts. You know, these are pretty common sense ideas. Mm-hmm. I just kind of packaged it in this nice little set of 5 because, and it really is, it comes from the past 2 decades of doing this work and watching and observing the issues that most commonly present. And, you know, over the past couple decades, I started to find myself telling my patients the same thing over and over again. And then it was, okay, I'm going to teach you these 4 things. And then it was, I'm going to teach you these 5 things. And then it just sort of like turned into the bucket rules, the 5 bucket rules. And then before you knew it, one of my patients made this beautiful handmade bucket that I have in my office. Mm-hmm. On the bottom is engraved Dr. G's bucket. And on the other side of it is engraved, "This is water," which is from David Foster Wallace's commencement speech, yes, where he talks about, I'm sure you're familiar with that speech.
Yes.
Brilliant, just brilliant. And really that's what he's talking about, is the water is the thoughts, feelings, and behaviors that live in our bucket. And so it just came together and we have this whole like shit analogy. It just works, right? Mm-hmm. And why is that important? Well, tools just aren't helpful if people can't access them, right? And sure, for each of those 5 rules, I could, you know, I could have them, you know, just really explained in like 10 words instead of 5 and use very eloquent, you know, psychology, vocabulary and whatnot, but nobody would fucking remember them, right? And you know, we also know that emotions are processed in a different part of the brain. So emotions are processed in the amygdala, in your emotion processing center. So they're the memory is in a different place too. So, you know, if you kind of use some profanity and it's intense and emotional, people will remember it. And really my goal is I want you to remember the concept here. So that's why there's a whole bunch of profanity, which is really popular with some people, but really offensive to some people. But I try to sort of justify and rationalize it as, no, there's a scientific reason that using profanity can actually be very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So the bucket rules just really came about from observation, observing my patients, seeing things come up and, you know, over and over again. And then I specialized in anxiety and trauma, specifically in my postdoctoral fellowship, which is like a residency. So, you know, a lot of these things are, they're just common sense, basic, but they follow this kind of natural order of things. So rule number one is you don't get to worry about shit that hasn't happened yet, right? And, you know, most people would listen to that and say, well, no shit, Sherlock, right? Why would you worry about things? But that's what most people do, especially all people with anxiety of any kind, whether it's trauma, obsessive, or just generalized anxiety. We worry about what happened. I'm okay with you thinking about what hasn't happened yet, but worrying is a whole different beast. Yeah. So, you know, and you know, I realize that this rule is kind of unfair, because what I'm saying is like, oh, you have anxiety? Don't have anxiety. Well, if it were that simple, if only it were that simple. But for me, it was important to have that as the first rule, because I wanted to operationalize the definition of anxiety. Anxiety is fortune telling. It's anxiety is fear. And what is it? It's worrying about shit that hasn't happened yet. And although in the research setting, there is actually a distinction made between fear and anxiety, you're probably familiar with it. In the clinical world, one of my patients would be able to tell you the difference between imminent and very soon, near future. Because when you have anxiety, you feel like at any moment something bad could happen. Is it that moment of, you know, a life threat? Sometimes it does feel like that. So how do you distinguish between immediate threat versus just something bad happening in the near future? Clinically, it doesn't pan out. So, you know, this idea that we are placing attention and focus on something that just hasn't happened yet is really what that first rule is about. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people just need that reminder, like, hey, it hasn't happened yet. So why am I putting effort and energy into these thoughts about the future? So that kind of takes you to rule number two, which kind of is subsumed under the rule number one. Rule number two is you don't get to worry about shit that is out of your control. And of course, the future is out of your control. But what's out of our control? And I always ask my patients, so what's out of your control? They're like, well, other people's, you know, X, Y, and Z. Yes, other people's thoughts, other people's feelings, other people's behaviors, what your department is going to do, what the economy is going to do, what the president's going to do, what, you know, what the pandemic's going to do. Like, we have no control over any of those things. And it's really not a good expenditure of energy for us to focus on things that are totally out of our control, right? And so that sort of leads us then to rule number three, which is, okay, what are we left with? We're left with our control. What's in us? Like, we are in control of us. And so that is represented by the bucket, which not coincidentally has a nice boundary on the outside of it, which is the difference between me and you, right? So we have to learn, and this is a very difficult thing for a lot of people I work with, that just understanding the difference between my thoughts and your thoughts. Your thoughts don't have to be my thoughts, and my thoughts don't need to become your thoughts. And what I think doesn't need to be how you feel. I mean, people just get all up in each other's buckets, but there is really a difference between how I think, how I feel, and what I decide to do versus how you think, how you feel, and what you decide to do. And when we are very clear in understanding those boundaries, we can learn how to be more assertive and how to better advocate for ourselves. And that's really what all of this is about, right? The self-improvement thing that we're working on in mental health. Rule number three is, handle your own shit, right? What is your shit? It's the shit in your bucket. Mm-hmm. And it's your thoughts, your feelings, and your behaviors. So along with that rule, if it's not in your bucket, so if it's not your shit, then fuck it. If it's not in your bucket, fuck it. And I have to also clarify, because so many of the times they're like, yeah, fuck them, fuck him, fuck her. And I'm like, no, time out. It's not fuck him, her, or they. It's fuck it. What is it? It is the worrying you're doing about things you have no control over, right? And, you know, like, to make this kind of more tangible, let's think about it this way. Like, what do most people worry about? They worry about what other people are thinking of them. How are people judging them? So people are now focused on impression management. And, oh my God, he doesn't like me. He likes me. She likes me. She doesn't. She's thinking I'm a total loser. He's thinking that I'm... We spend so much effort, energy, and time focused on what we... On mind reading, basically. Thinking what other people are thinking. And the reality is at the end of the day, we really just project how we think about ourselves in the world and other people on everybody else. Because if we're thinking it, we think everybody else is thinking it. So if you think other people are thinking you're a loser, they're not, right? Because we're just innately hardwired to be pretty selfish, self-absorbed, self-directed animals. Mm-hmm. You think you're a loser. That's where this came from, right? Yep. So between worrying about what people think about us and worrying how they feel, right? Oh, he's angry because of me, to me, because of me, of me, about me. No, no, no. He's just angry. Are people allowed because of this free will and autonomy thing? Are people allowed to be angry? Yes, they're allowed to be angry, right? Of course they're allowed to be angry. So, and then what are they going to do? Is he going to cheat on me? Is she going to cheat on me? We don't have any control over those things. But if you think about it, most people probably spend a majority of their time focused on everybody else's buckets. Mm-hmm. If we just took all that energy and refocused it on ourselves and learned to manage our stories, manage our narratives, especially when they are negative, you know, unhealthy ones. And then that will change the way we feel, and that will change the way we behave and the way we experience our day-to-day life. Right? That's really what that rule number three is about. That middle core, it's in the middle of the rules and not coincidentally, right? And then these last two rules are like, okay, in this mission of not worrying about shit that hasn't happened yet and not worrying about shit that's out of our control and then handling our own shit, what can help us do that? The thing that comes up over and over again, you know, because anxiety often manifests as anger, as irritability, frustration, annoyance, whatever words people like to sugarcoat it with, anger is anger. And it, you know, anger comes from having an expectation that is not met, from being disappointed because something is not the way you think it should be. So we do a lot of shoulding, right? I can't take credit for the terms shoulding and masturbating. Actually, Albert Ellis, one of our forefathers, came up with that in his, he was one of our first cognitive behavioral and rationally emotive therapists. And it's just, he really contributed so much to the field. But we do a lot of shoulding, right? Which happens to also kind of sound like shit. So see, this whole theme works, right?
Shooting out of our mouths all the time.
It's shooting all the time. We're shooting. So the rule is no shooting on yourself or anybody else, right? They should, I should, I shouldn't. And that's really critical because people with anxiety and depression and trauma, which is a little bit of both anxiety and depression, they tend to do a lot of self-blaming and a lot of shooting. A lot of shoulda, woulda, coulding, right? Especially for depression. But with trauma, a lot of shooting. You know, he shouldn't have raped me. They shouldn't have done this. They should understand. They should be more supportive. People should leave me alone. It's like we're shooting all over the place. And it just festers and it manufactures anger. And that may anger and perpetuation of anger is just by this constant shooting thoughts. And also the masturbating, which is must, need to, and have to. I mean, as soon as you say, I must, or you must, you need to, you have to go to the gym today. I mean, doesn't your anxiety go up? Suddenly you're like, I must, I need to, I have to. So what I offer to my patients is instead of using those terms, you can wish, want, hope, and would like until the cows come home. You're allowed to wish, want, hope, and would like. Wish as much as you want. Hope as much as you want. Would like as much as you want. These words give you a little more space. They're a little more forgiving and compassionate. You know, they give you a little bit of wiggle room so you can kind of in that wishing and wanting and hoping, you're also kind of the understanding is there's radical acceptance that you don't have control over some part of this.
Yeah.
Right. And that's really critical. That's a really critical part of forgiveness and compassion is radical acceptance. Acceptance, or if it seems absurd to have to accept something, we can call it radical acceptance. Mm. Right. And so this rule it's one of the most helpful rules for my patients. As soon as I teach it to them, they start hearing the should in everybody else's statements. And they're like, wow, there's a lot of angry people out there and they're shoulding all the time. You know, sometimes I'll have someone that's like, I'm not shoulding, but he's supposed to. And I'm like, that's a should, that's a should. That's a camouflage should, right?
Yeah, camouflage.
And then the last rule is actually...
I'll just say really quick that I'm kind of realizing now more clearly that shitting and masturbating relate a lot to attempting to control the shit you can't control.
Because that's absolutely
that's kind
right.
of what's implied by saying I should have, he should have, or must. So that's interesting. Okay.
That's brilliant. That's exactly right, Nick. And that's what people with anxiety want to do is we want that compensatory behavior is to become suddenly over-controlling, or sometimes I use the word strategic. So I have patients with anxiety, they're very strategizing, right? We're going to go at this time, we're going to park here, we're going to go here, we're only going to go here if this is the circumstance. I need 2 days in advance notice. That kind of control comes from a sense of powerlessness that we have when we chronically experience anxiety, right? Which naturally, it becomes sort of a negative feedback loop and a perpetuating factor, because the anxiety is because we're fortune telling, and then we think the fortune telling and then the strategizing, the compensatory controlling avoidance behaviors are going to help us get more control, but actually end up counterintuitively, right? We end up feeling even less in control than we did before, right? So I always tell my patients, you know, if you just let go of everybody else's buckets, truly fuck it, right? Just fuck it. That's their bucket. Not going to worry about it. I'm just going to focus on me. It's like a weight lifted off of you. And actually, you end up feeling more in control of things than you ever did before by letting go of control, right? It's very counterintuitive. But you're absolutely right. The shoulding is that attempt. And it really is an avoidance strategy. Right? Avoidance can take a lot of sneaky forms. It's not always just like literally avoiding talking, thinking, or, you know, writing or being exposed to anxiety provoking situations. Avoidance can be done by staying super busy. It can be done by drinking, retail therapy, you know, all kinds of other things. But shoulding and some of these thought processes can also be ways of avoiding. So that was brilliant. That was a very, very nice point. Thank you for bringing that up.
Absolutely. On to my favorite.
And then the last rule is that your favorite?
This one's coming up right now. This is my favorite.
Yeah. And I have to sort of kind of put out a caveat, which is the field of psychology and mental health is all about people's feelings. So of course we care about feelings. And in between, if I were going to put another little like note in between rule number 4 and 5, I would say, practice mindfulness, use the compassion statement, right? Because we do teach mindfulness when you are feeling something, whatever you're feeling, be in that moment. I'm feeling angry. It's okay. I'm having a moment of suffering. Suffering is a part of life. I'm feeling hot. My jaw is clenched. I feel the vein in my forehead throbbing. I feel hot. I'm noticing lots of thoughts that are angry. I'm noticing lots of violent thoughts. I'm noticing, ooh, there's a dark one. I'm noticing. And I like to teach mindfulness in a very third person so that we remove ourselves from the thoughts so that we understand that we are not our thoughts. Mm-hmm. And once we've done that, you know, may I be kind to myself? May I be in this moment? It doesn't mean anything, right? So once we've done that mindfulness, we can move on to rule number 5, which is fuck feelings. If it's healthy, do it anyway. Right? Which again is me giving permission to my patients and everybody else to just choose your behaviors based on whether it's something you want in your life. It's this whole idea of living with intention, right? Do you want to be a fit, healthy person? Then fuck feelings. Go to the gym even when you don't feel like it. Mm-hmm. Do you want to keep your family? Well, then you got to hang out with them once in a while, right? Do you want to keep your marriage? You should probably take your, I don't want to should, but it would be a good thing to engage interpersonally with your wife if you want to keep her once in a while and take her out to dinner, right? I know it's anxiety provoking and you don't want to sit at the table, but you also don't want her to wait 3 hours because you're waiting for the one in the corner, the room, the table in the corner with the view of the door and the exit, right? So fuck feelings. If it's healthy, do it anyway. This is also extremely helpful for people who experience depression because, and really that's where this came from, although it's super helpful with for people with anxiety as well. When we are depressed, part of the nature of the beast is we don't want to do anything, right? But actually doing things is how we get out of that depressive episode. Yeah. So, you know, I would hear, I mean, I hear all week long, Doc, I know you wanted me to exercise more, but I didn't feel like it. Doc, I know you wanted me to go do this exposure, but I was too anxious. I couldn't do it. I didn't feel like it, right? Doc, I know you wanted me to go be out in a crowd, but I just couldn't do it. I didn't feel like I could handle it. Fuck feelings. Since when do our behaviors have to rely on our temporary fickle mood of the moment? Never. And so the way I drive this point home is I always ask for people to raise their hand and I ask them, how many of you feel like going to work every day? But you go. How many of you feel like walking your dog every day? I mean, sometimes it's your dog walking you, right? Let's be realistic, especially if you have anxiety or mood things or trauma going on. How many of you feel like hearing screaming children when you go home? But you haven't moved out. So we already do tons of things that we don't feel like doing, but we prioritize them. But maybe we need to start thinking about our brain health and our because mental health and physical health are one and the same. They are not two separated things. Right. Maybe we would benefit from starting to think about our mental health as a priority as well, right? And so, you know, that rule, it's also easy to remember. Fuck feelings, do it anyway, right? And I have to explain to people, we care about your feelings, but we're not gonna let feelings dictate the decisions you make for your life. I mean, feelings come and go, they're based on thoughts. Are all of your thoughts credible? Just because it's in your head doesn't mean it's right, doesn't mean it's logical, rational, doesn't mean it's helpful or healthy, doesn't mean it serves you well. So let's not go there. So those are the bucket rules. And the reason that's five is because, I mean, because we could certainly add 10 more. Yeah. But when people have anxiety and depression, it's hard to remember things. It's really hard to remember things. And even after 6 months of treating people, sometimes I'm like, what are the rules? They don't remember. They might remember one. It's usually the fuck feelings rule. Right? Or it's if it's not your bucket, fuck it. Mm-hmm. But I will say, just adopting some of those very fundamental strategies, if you were to just make 5 changes in your life, those 5 would be a really good bang for the buck.
Mm. Yes. And the fuck feeling ones, I was really thinking about this deeply. And I got the sense when I read your book that you understand, like you keep emphasizing, the value of emotions. You understand that often emotions signal us, and that's kind of in the way that the movie Inside Out depicts, where they
beautiful movie.
and they often propel us to do exactly what needs to be done. But especially I think when people have experienced trauma or their anxiety levels are very, very high, when there's no immediate real threat, it's like those emotions are not really calibrated anymore.
Right.
And in a sense, you have to, like, you know, the phrase that came to my mind too was, I don't want to, but I will anyway, or I want to, but I will not. And I often even think of like just this, the idea of what is discipline, what is willpower. I think that it always involves being able to do what you don't feel like doing, but want to have done, and not do what you feel like doing, but don't want to have done.
And I love that. The way I put it for my patients, because often It's like they want to do the things that are not helpful and they want to not do things that are helpful. So I say, I want you to live on opposite world. Here's the rule. If you feel like doing it, don't do it. If you want to do it, if you don't feel like doing it, do it, right? Because generally that will be a good rule of thumb. And it is very challenging for them.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
I mean, for all of us, right? I mean, we don't want to do what we don't want to do. But, you know, this is, brings up another important issue, which is often in this mission to make change, in this, with this idea of transformation, like, when do we make change? I mean, I really believe that we don't change until we have to, and we don't have to until we hit a rock bottom. And a rock bottom is not what other people think it is or what society thinks it is. It's your rock bottom. But I have to ask patients once in a while, you know, how much worse are you willing to let things get before you're willing to make change? Because you've already lost your job, you're losing your spouse and your child custody, you've lost your sleep and your health. Like, how much more are you willing to lose? And of course, the very sort of dark end of that is you could lose your life over this, right? Slowly or quickly. And so, you know, this is it's a very sobering thought. But sometimes when we're working with people who, or for people listening to this podcast, if you have had trouble changing or making great, you know, really important change in your life, ask yourself that question. You know, how much more am I willing to lose? How much worse am I okay with things getting before I'm willing to really do something painful and miserable and, you know, fuck feelings, I'm going to do it anyway. What is that breaking point? Because we all have one.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, some people's rock bottom, they don't get to come back from.
It's a great way to think about it. And it highlights the executive function of our brain, the fact that we are capable as human beings of generating impulses to act that are not really coming from those deeply ingrained regions of our brain, those kind of like the you know, those dopamine pathways that have been carved out in deep paths that keep us in our habits of just pleasure seeking behavior or avoidance behavior. And so, in other words, the current of the rivers in our mind can get really strong, and yet sometimes we have to go against it anyway. But in against it, you can establish new currents in your thought patterns and emotional and behavioral patterns.
And sometimes, Nick, those are the most rewarding ones, aren't they?
Yes. Yes. Indeed.
I mean, human nature, if something's given to you, you know, if somebody gives you, you know, a $200 pair of Nikes, you may not value them as much as if you had to work for every single dollar and it took you a week to work for that money. You know, we value what we have to work for. And in the field of mental health and mental wellness, this doesn't happen on its own. Mm-hmm. You know, we are hardwired, I think, as animals to be fear driven. Mm-hmm. So it's really not a surprise that anxiety is our most commonly diagnosed disorder, right? We're hardwired for it.
Yeah.
But we also have some gifts, gifts or blessings or curses that other animals don't have. For example, other animals don't have this ability to hang on to memories in the same way. They may engage in and learn through conditioned learning, but you know, like your dog is going to stop barking after the noise subsides in the middle of the night, but you might still be looking out the window for the next 5 hours. Right? Like we are the only animal that can predict and fortune tell. And I mean, we can't predict, but we try to. I mean, we're the only animal that's capable of some of these higher cognitive abilities. Yes. And it's really a double-edged sword, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. Right. Because we don't know what it's like, of course, in the consciousness of another creature, but as humans, we have a mental representation. We have a mental world and we have a mental representation of the external world, which can sometimes be constructed in a very anxiety provoking way.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Wow. Well, I'm just inspired by the way you've responded to this experience, the way you kind of seized the opportunity. Like I said in the beginning, you have this very unique, you're uniquely equipped to talk about everything we've been talking about, because you come from this depth of personal experience, and you have, you know, knowledge systematically in place. The one more question that I wanted to ask was, and it's okay if the answer is no, it might be, but was there anything that you had believed or learned about trauma and recovering from it that was kind of invalidated by this experience?
That's a tough question.
Yeah.
And I have to think about that for a second. I mean, I would say it's probably the opposite. It was that everything I had learned, I mean, the traumatic things that I had gone through in earlier times in my life, I didn't have this therapist knowledge, you know, I didn't have all the academic intellectual knowledge of. And so that's what made the Route 91 trauma so interesting for me. And I would say that, you know, everything was like everything in the books actually ended up being validated, although there were some of those curious things, like I was trying to understand, like, why couldn't I remember these dead bodies, these people who had died? Why couldn't I? And you know, it was complicated, because it wasn't really just about, well, I can't remember. It was guilt. I felt guilty that I couldn't remember. And that sort of feeds into something else that I know you emailed me earlier about, which was that one phrase in the book. And I didn't go into detail, you know, again, because the book was a tool and I didn't want the focus to all be on me. It was more just to lead by example. Here's what happened, so that people had enough to know they could relate. But there was a little brief period of time in that first few months that things just got really dark in my head. And it wasn't dark in the sense of like having suicidal thoughts or anything, but, and you know, I'm not particularly proud of these thoughts. I felt really ashamed and guilty having these thoughts after the fact. But when me and this group of people had come back, you know, like I said, everybody had such a different experience. I was still in shock. We were all in shock, trying to figure out what happened and trying to understand it. And people were writing their stories. And some of the folks that I had been there with, not my primary friend group of girlfriends, I mean, I didn't have the same experience because they were all gone. But this kind of secondary group of friends we had met a couple nights before, you know, one of the guys wrote up his story and on Facebook. Everybody was in it except me, right? And while we were getting shot at, I was sitting on his legs. I mean, we were talking, I was like, oh, I'm sorry, I'm sitting on your legs, right? He was like, that's what you're thinking of right now? I was like, yeah, well, we're all crouched in, right? And I mean, to get left out, and you know, again, it was just shocking. And then the other guy that we were both kind of stuck without any cover, everybody else had gotten in under the table, and the two of us were totally exposed. And, you know, there had been a lot of drinking. I don't drink, but there had been a lot of drinking. And so, you know, the first part of it, again, back to the perceived danger, he's like, don't worry about it. Everybody's freaking out. Don't worry about it. Right. Well, one of the girls in the group was videotaping this. And on the videotape, my voice is saying, okay, but I really think you should get down. I really don't think you should be standing. Right. And in a second clip of that video, which I still have, you know, he's like, fuck, it's bullets. I'm getting down now, right? And when we spoke in that like subsequent few weeks or months, he's like, oh yeah, I don't remember you being there. I was like, what the fuck, right? And so like I go through this event and two people that I talked to didn't even remember me being there or didn't report me being there. And all these people died around us. And I started having some fucking terrible thoughts that I'm not proud of, that I really even hesitate to say out loud, but I'm going in the spirit of leading by example and just being a human being about this. I started having this thought for a few weeks. I was like, wow, like, it didn't even fucking matter that I, like, how could they not remember that I was there with them? I mean, we almost died. If I had died, would they remember me? Like, would I have mattered if I had died? Would they have said, oh yes, and my friend Shiva, or this person we met, Shiva, who was really cool, like, she died in front of us. Like, would I have even been worth a mention? And, you know, I mean, obviously in hindsight, like, it's just totally unfair to even think like that, because we all process trauma in a different way. I didn't remember half the shit that happened. So of course, one of the guy that was, you know, caught on video with me talking to him, he didn't, but he blocked out stuff too, right? And maybe I just wasn't a central person in the, for this other guy. I mean, you know, there's, but it really, I think, and it really took me a while to process this. I talked to another guy that was in that friend group, and I, you know, and I talked and cried on the phone. I was like, I just don't understand. I just don't understand. And I think really what this was about, Nick, was dealing with our own mortality. You know, I think it was just coming so close to death and not being acknowledged or remembered, at least per their report, right? By the people who I was there and I survived with. I kept thinking, like, wow, if I died, would anybody have been there? Would I have died alone? And, you know, this was a really big deal in this venue, because there were, in fact, there were people in our support group in the San Diego area who literally had dying people in their laps. They were there in the last moments of life for people they didn't even know, people that were just, they were standing next to or sitting next to. So what became very important in the recovery process was, especially for family members of those people, was that they didn't die alone. You know, there was somebody there with them in the final moments of life. And I think as I look back, I think that's what it was about. It wasn't, I don't think it was an ego thing, like, oh, I should be important enough that people remember me. It wasn't a validation thing. I think it was really a much deeper issue of our mortality and having somebody there at the end to witness our life and then our death. And, you know, I always talk to my patients about this. You know, it's so hardwired in all of us to find companionship. And I think that one of the issues with companionship is that really what that's about is having people in our life that can witness our life. You know, it's kind of like if a tree falls in the forest and nobody hears it, did it fall? Right? I mean, if you live your life and there's nobody that can witness it, I don't know, what is the meaning? What is the value? And this gets back to this idea that we're very social animals.
Yeah.
So I think that was, it was a real existential crisis for me. And I think it just lasted for a few weeks. And then I just, the guilt I felt, because I was like, oh my God, like, I shouldn't even be having this thought. You know, I survived, and I would never wish to have been shot. It was more just like, if I had been shot, would anybody have remembered me? Or would I have just been this nameless, faceless woman laying dead on the turf? That's a dark thought.
That's a deep, it's really deep. And
it's a dark thought.
Yeah.
I'm but sure in the phrase, go through trauma,
yeah,
have that.
That's what I was going to emphasize. The phrase that, you know, for people listening, that Dr. Guide was referring to, that I had pointed out in preliminary conversations, was trauma can take even the healthiest people down a dark path. Yeah. So I appreciate you, like telling us what
this is the first time I've talked about this, Nick. You're the lucky guy. I've never talked about this, you know, other than with my mom, because I had written it in that first version. And I had talked to a couple of people just, you know, verbally with about this whole thing, because I was trying to understand it too. And I do consider myself to be I know I'm kind of biased, but I do think I'm the healthiest, one of the healthiest people I know. And it was just a really, to use a social psychology term, there was a lot of cognitive dissonance there, having that thought, because, you know, it's like, oh my God, why even fathom something like that? I'm so grateful that I didn't get shot. But if I had been shot, would anybody fucking remember me or know me? Or would I have just died alone? And that was a really terrifying thought for me, along with the terror of almost dying. That thought of just being at the end, not having anybody you know, or anybody who cares about you to be there with you. It's just it is not a fun thought. You know, it is not a fun thought. And I think that thought process is also not limited to the Route 91 experience. In fact, I think that probably is something everybody since COVID broke can relate to, right? Because we had so many people dying in hospitals, and early on, not even being able to FaceTime because there were so many people dying all at the same time. The doctors have been overloaded. They didn't even have the ability to pull up FaceTime or some sort of, you know, app to say goodbye to their loved ones. So you're, you know, dying with masks and PPE, and just, it's like this sci-fi type of scenario. And I have a feeling that, so maybe in describing and kind of elaborating on this for your podcast, Nick, maybe there are people who have had this experience or can really relate to that specific type of dark thought since COVID, since the pandemic started, because it really is very relevant. It's our mortality, you know?
Yes. Wow. Yeah, you've taken me down a thought process that I haven't had to confront, you know, and I think you're onto something with part of the motivation for us to be so connected to other people is to feel like our life is real, that it exists.
That it actually happened.
Yes.
And that it means something, right? And that it means something. And I wanted to clarify that because, you know, that sentence that was left ambiguous intentionally, because going into all this detail would just bring up a whole other set of discussions. Although those discussions would be very relevant right now. And that book was intended for people who go through any kind of trauma or even have anxiety and depression, not just for people who've been through mass shootings. And certainly the relevance is very, very high with the global pandemic. But, you know, my sense is that people might interpret that sentence in a different way and might think that going dark means suicidal thoughts. And certainly it probably does mean that for a lot of people, but there are many ways that we can go dark, you know, and going dark for me was a little bit different, but felt very, very distressing at the time. And I finally had to sort of retell that narrative and tell myself, you know, everybody has the autonomy and the freedom to tell their story however they need to tell it. Our own journey, our own process of trauma, and everybody's process is about them and them only. I don't need to be a part of everybody's healing process or recovery process or story. Even if I was there, maybe I'm not really an important part of that. And that's okay. That's okay, right?
Yeah.
So I had to kind of talk myself out of that whole thing, that thought process that, wow, I could have fucking died and nobody would give a shit. It wouldn't have mattered. I'd be there by myself sitting on, you know, just laying out. I had to talk myself out of that story and remind myself that, you know, I do matter to the handful of people in my own life that I'm close to. And my life is meaningful because of those people in my life. And I'm going to, come hell or high water, I'm going to make this experience meaningful. I'm going to help as many people as I can so that as few people develop PTSD as possible, right? Given the shortage of mental health providers nationwide. And I'm going to move forward in my life and live with intention and live mindfully and live with gratitude and live with compassion for myself and other people. And I was able to do that. So after a few weeks, I was able to kind of shake that horrible set of dark thoughts off. I was able to move forward from that. But that's part of that process, right? And I'm guessing I probably wasn't alone in that. There was the other side of that. One of the guys in our community kept saying, why was I there? Why did I have to see 3 people die? Why did they have to be in my arms? You know, because these weren't people he knew. I mean, I said, well, they're very lucky that you were there. They're really lucky that they didn't die alone. And I'm sure their families are eternally grateful that there was somebody holding their hand at the end, you know, because not everybody had that. And not everybody, even on a normal day, not everybody has that in this country. We have people who are homeless that die alone. We have people that are living alone, the American lifestyle, right? The American dream. We work, 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 and people are separated from their family units and all over the country following jobs. People die alone all the time. So, you know, this is, and again, with the pandemic, this just raises this whole thought process. So I wasn't sure if you would have anticipated that might be the direction of this, of that question that you would ask me.
Yeah, I wasn't sure. Yeah, and to the question a couple questions ago of whether anything you had learned prior had kind of been invalidated, I gather that it wasn't that it was invalidated, but it was validated, and that there was more to learn from that experience. That's what.
Yes, actually, that is a perfect way to put it. It was that everything I studied was validated, but I had this richer, deeper understanding and true empathy, mm-hmm. not just compassion and not just sympathy, but empathy for people who have been through these things. I will say, you know, it was very humbling. It was very, very humbling. Trauma is one thing that I knew from, you know, years of treating people is, you know, trauma, people feel very isolated, uniquely alone. And having experienced it, you know, and also being a little arrogant early on and thinking, oh, I'll be fine, right? Mm-hmm. And then the trauma symptoms started 2 weeks after. But I knew not to avoid, right? So I never meet criteria for PTSD because I don't do the avoidance piece. But it was so humbling, Nick. I was like, wow, with all my knowledge and everything, I'm doing everything right. My brain's just still doing what it's doing, right? And I'm not avoiding, and I'm doing exactly what I would teach my patients to do. And it was humbling. It makes you feel small. It makes you feel that almost in awe of the human body and the human brain. And like I said, it was a very curious process to observe myself through all of that. What was surprising I kind of knew this already, but just that feeling of complete just being alone, even though you're surrounded by friends, surrounded by family, there's just something incredibly isolating about trauma. It's almost like it just puts up a little shield, a little bubble around you, or you put it up, or it goes up, and no matter what people say and do, and it just, you feel really truly alone. And of course, it's really about the trauma narrative. So getting out of that mindset and reminding ourselves we are not alone. That's why healing in groups is so important for humans. Yeah. You know, even if the human group is suffering together, you are together.
Yes.
And that's how we heal. But yeah, trauma is very isolating. And it's truly humbling. I was truly humbled as a therapist because I really thought the first couple of weeks, I was convinced I was going to be just fine.
Yeah. And just like a final reflection on the group. I know, you know, I've had I don't think I would go, I try to use the word trauma carefully. I think that I don't know if you've heard the term. It's gaining popularity, but the term is concept creep, and it was coined
I've
by
never heard that. Oh, wow.
the psychologist coined the term to refer to this phenomenon where what we consider to be, let's say we just start to use words more loosely, essentially,
Yeah.
that
I appreciate what you're saying right now. Very, very much, Nick. Very, very much. Because I do think that people throw around the terms trauma, traumatic event, traumatizing, and PTSD way too nonchalantly. Right? And really, how we define trauma clinically is it has to meet a certain set of criteria. To get a diagnosis of PTSD, and what we call a traumatic event clinically is something that is life-threatening to you or someone close to you, right? How do you tend to use the word?
Like that. I try to use it that strictly.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, because I suppose there are examples where there were words that we were using too narrowly. So letting that concept kind of creep out a little bit to envelop more people's experience, I suppose, could be helpful. But when you let it expand too far, it just gets
Yeah.
harder to understand what we're really talking about. And it creates almost too much diversity within the group of people who have had this thing that we're calling, let's say, trauma, or even you could say in some cases the word assault or violence or things like that apply too. So I try to use it strictly, and yeah. And I know I was going to say too, with my own emotional distress, my own difficulty, especially with losing loved ones. For me, there's been a lot of death throughout my life. And so people I've loved dying untimely deaths has been the hardest thing for me to overcome and just respond to in life. And I remember when my mom died, that was the big one. I was only 22, which is
I'm so
too young,
sorry.
and I
So,
was not ready,
yeah.
thankfully. And I remember I had individual therapy and I had group therapy, and both were, I felt, very helpful. Yet the group therapy was special. There was
Is.
something about that. And I have such grateful thoughts about my therapist in the individual therapy. She was wonderful. But there was something that the group therapy did that nothing else could have done. And
Yep.
something, a level of like therapeutic experience that could only come about with this field of empathy that you're in when you're in a group support situation.
Absolutely. And research supports that, right? Research supports that. I'm so sorry that you've had those losses. And literally that, unexpected losses, especially many of them put together, I mean, that would qualify as trauma, right? But like you said, I think when people come into my office and they're like, "Oh my God, this thing happened and it was so traumatizing," I'm like, "Whoa, whoa, 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 whoa! What was the trauma? What happened?" Because when people use that word, I think, "Okay, rape, near death, molestation, natural disaster, combat, life-threatening accident, something that is high level." Because really, I think what people use the word it, which would be more accurately described by is emotionally distressing, right? So we don't want to minimize things, but we don't want to also overblow things and call them trauma because nowadays that's such a heavily, just a loaded word. And especially with the word PTSD, and sometimes that has other associations. And, so I really am sort of a stickler for how I use these words. And it's same by the same token, people will say, "I'm so depressed." Are you depressed or are you just feeling down? Because depression is a clinical diagnosed, disorder to be in a depressive episode. And there's actual criteria we need to meet. But if you're so depressed because you had a sad thing happen today and tomorrow you're happy, maybe you're not depressed. Maybe you're just feeling kind of down, right? But again, I realize we have to be a little forgiving with the way we use words. But I tell my patients all the time, words have weight. There's a gravity every time you use a word. So we have to use them. They have power. We have to use them very carefully. Use words with intention.
Exactly.
So,
exactly.
Yeah, but I agree with that. Yeah, it's a loaded word for sure.
It is. And often when you see it defined, you see the word extreme in the definition. Like you'll see the definition of extreme emotional distress, and people are using that word to differentiate it from emotional distress, which is also really hard. But trauma is, I think, inherently an extreme experience of emotional distress. So, yeah. Anyway, I'm glad that came up here at the end. I think it's an interesting topic. We've been talking for 2.5 hours. Somehow.
I know. And isn't it fun? There's just a never ending pot of topics. And, you know, I love what I do. It's clear to me that you love what you do as well. And we kind of do the same thing. So, you know, I'm very passionate about all of this, and I could talk probably to you about this for hours and hours and hours. So I'd love to do that again in the future.
I was going to say, yes.
We can definitely connect. I'm actually hoping to launch a podcast in September due to popular demand, because for 10 years, my patients have been begging me to start a podcast.
Beautiful.
So it's somebody reached out to me a few months ago and said, hey, can we like put all these things together in a podcast? Just things that I teach my patients about, you know, trauma disorders, anxiety disorders, other mood disorders, interpersonal relationships, and just general wellness tools and stuff. So I'm going to put that together, and I'd love to stay connected with you, Nick.
Yes.
And maybe, you know, I mean, I'm going to have some that are just very psychoeducational and teachy, but then I'd love to have some that are just a conversation between two professionals and, you know, two people in the field. I think that would be very, very interesting.
Beautiful. Well, I'm sure you'll have it on your website when it's ready, right? And can you tell people what's your website URL?
We'll probably put a link up on a few different sites. So my private practice, which I'm not running right now, but the site is drshivaguide.com. But the Route 91 stuff is on route91therapy.com. Mm. And the book is also up on loveexpands.com, which I co-founded with a very good friend of mine, which is all about lots of positive psychology things and lots of wellness articles by many different professionals across the field. So I'll probably put it up and then spread it on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all that stuff. I'm not very active on those, but just to kind of get the word out, I really want people to just be educated and have new words and new ways to think about mental illness and mental health.
Yes. Beautiful. Well, I too am so glad we're connected and intend to stay connected. So
I love that.
I think of this as the beginning of our professional relationship, and I'm so happy that it has started. And
I so appreciate you reaching out, and I apologize because I need to get better about checking that other email account.
You got back to me eventually. The timing was perfect.
I appreciate that. It's really truly been a pleasure talking to you.
Likewise. And I'll just say to everyone who's still listening, thank you so much for staying tuned in. I'm glad it was interesting enough to listen to the whole time. So Dr. Guide, I'll reach out to you again when we publish
please,
this.
Yeah.
We got a little backlog, so it'll probably get published in a couple of weeks. But
I appreciate you reaching out, and you know, your mission is obviously the same as my mission, which is to destigmatize this whole field of psychology and mental illness and explain what mental health is and get people healthy. Thank you for that.
Mm. Well, my kindred spirit, I hope you have a wonderful day, and I thank you for sharing your story and your knowledge.
Thank you, Nick. And I'll look forward to talking to you again soon.
Perfect. Bye for now.